unnamed man to go into Boston for the purpose of conveying intelligence of the enemy's movements and designs. The fear that the British were preparing an attack was ever present. We scarcely lie down or rise up, but with expectation that the night or the day must produce some important event, wrote one of Washington's staff. It was in the first week of August, at the end of his first month as commander, when Washington learned how much worse things were than he knew. A report on the supply of gunpowder at hand revealed a total of less than 10,000 pounds, and the situation was not expected to improve soon. Very little gunpowder was produced in the colonies. What supplies there were came mainly by clandestine shipments from Europe to New York and Philadelphia, by way of the Dutch island St. Eustatius in the Caribbean. At present, there was powder enough only for about 9 rounds per man. According to one account, Washington was so stunned by the report, he did not utter a word for half an hour. The sprawling American encampments bore little resemblance to the usual military presence. Tents and shelters were mainly patched together concoctions of whatever could be found. Each was a portraiture of the temper and taste of the person who encamps in it, wrote clergyman Emerson. Some are made of boards, some of sailcloth, and some partly of one and partly of the other. Others are made of stone and turf, and others again of brick and others brush. Some are thrown up in a hurry and look as if they could not help it, mere necessity. Others are curiously wrought with doors and windows. A notable exception was the encampment of Nathaniel Greene's Rhode Islanders. There, proper tents were arranged row on row, like the regular camp of the enemy, everything in the most exact English taste, recorded Emerson approvingly. On the whole, however, he thought the great variety of the camps most picturesque. Others were considerably less charmed. The drunken carousing to be seen, the foul language to be heard, were appalling to many, even among the soldiers themselves. "Wickedness prevails very much," declared Lieutenant Joseph Hodgkins of Ipswich, Massachusetts. A veteran of Bunker Hill and a cobbler by trade, Hodgkins was 32 years old, and a man like many who had already seen a good deal of trouble and sorrow in his life. His first wife and 4 of their 5 children had all died of disease before the war began. To the remaining child and to his second wife, Sarah Perkins, and the 2 children born of this second marriage, he was a devoted father and husband. Greatly concerned for their welfare and knowing her concern for him, he wrote to Sarah at every chance. But for now, as he told her, he had no time to be particular about details. A British ship surgeon who used the privileges of his profession to visit some of the rebel camps described roads crowded with carts and wagons, hauling mostly provisions, but also, he noted, inordinate quantities of rum, for without New England rum, a New England army could not be kept together. The rebels, he calculated, were consuming a bottle a day per man. To judge by the diary of an officer with the Connecticut troops at Roxbury, Lieutenant Jabez Fitch, who enjoyed a sociable drink, there was considerably more besides plain rum to be had. "Drank some grog," he recorded, at the close of one day, after a stop at a nearby tavern. "The gin sling passed very briskly," reads another entry. "In the morning I attended the alarm post as usual, then down to Lieutenant Brewster's tent to drink Ensign Perkins' cherry rum, came back and eat breakfast. He imbibed wine and brandy sling, and on an expedition up into Cambridge Town, after a stop to sample some flip, a sweet, potent mix of liquor, beer, and sugar, he made for another tavern, the Punch Bowl, where there was fiddling and dancing in great plenty. I came home a little before daylight in." Lieutenant Fitch was one of a number of veterans of the French and Indian War, an easy-going Norwich, Connecticut farmer and father of 8 children. He enjoyed soldiering, and felt so sure his 14-year-old son would, too, that he'd brought the boy along with him. Lieutenant Fitch, an early member of the Sons of Liberty, had been one of the first to answer the call for reinforcements for Boston. Little seemed ever to bother him, though he did object to soldiers dirty as hogs. Much of his free time he spent writing in his diary to his wife. "The sound of British shells overhead was like that of a flock of geese," he wrote, "and has done more to exhilarate the spirits of our people than 200 gallons of New England rum. For all its lack of ammunition, tents, and uniforms, the army was amply fed. Fresh produce in abundance and at low prices rolled into the camps all through summer and early fall. The men could count on meat or fish almost every day. Jabez Fitch wrote of enjoying fresh eggs, clams, apples, peaches, and watermelons, a very good breakfast of warm bread and good camp butter with a good dish of coffee, a hearty dinner of pork and cabbage. As yet, no one was complaining of a shortage of food. There had been sickness aplenty from the start, deadly camp fever, which grew worse as summer went on. Anxious mothers and wives from the surrounding towns and countryside came to nurse the sick and dying. "Your brother Elihu lies very dangerously sick with a dysentery. His life is despaired of," wrote Abigail Adams from nearby Braintree to her husband John in Philadelphia. "Your mother is with him in great anguish." Captain Elihu Adams, a farmer with a wife and three children, was one of several hundred who died of illness. Camp fever, or putrid fever, were terms used for the highly infectious, deadly scourges of dysentery, typhus, and typhoid fever, the causes of which were unknown or only partially understood. Dysentery had been the curse of armies since ancient times, as recorded by Herodotus. Typhus, characterized by high fever, severe headaches, and delirium, was carried by lice and fleas, which were a plague amid the army. One soldier recorded seeing a dead body so covered with lice that it was thought the lice alone had killed the man. Typhoid fever, also characterized by a raging fever, red rash, vomiting, diarrhea, and excruciating abdominal pain, was caused by the Bacillus salmonella typhosa in contaminated food or water, usually the result of too little separation between sewage and drinking water. And it was not the troops alone who suffered from camp fever. Many of those who came to nurse them were sickened or carried the disease home, and thus it lay waste to one New England town after another. Of the parishioners of a single church in Danbury, Connecticut, more than 100 would die of camp fever by November. Infectious filth was understood to be the killer. Cleanliness in person, clean cooking utensils, clean water, and unspoiled meat and produce were seen as essential to the prolonged health of the army. And this was among the chief reasons for constant insistence on discipline and order, and especially with so many thousands encamped in such close company. As it was, open latrines were the worst of it, but there was also, as recorded in one orderly book, a great neglect of people repairing to the necessaries. Instead, they voided excrement about the fields perniciously. The smell of many camps was vile in the extreme. New England men were also averse to washing their own clothes, considering that women's work. The British included women in their army, wives and other so-called camp followers, some of whom were prostitutes, who did the washing. But that was not the way with the New Englanders. The troops were in good spirits, but had yet to accept the necessity of order or obedience. Many had volunteered on the condition that they could elect their own officers, and the officers, in turn, were inclined out of laziness, or for the sake of their own popularity, to let those in the ranks do much as they pleased. Many of the officers had little or no idea of what they were supposed to do. The officers in general, remembered John Trumbull, were quite as ignorant of military life as the troops. Washington had declared new rules and regulations in force, insisting on discipline, and he made his presence felt by reviewing the defenses on horseback almost daily. "New lords, new laws," observed Pastor Emerson. "New orders from His Excellency are read to the respective regiments every morning after prayers. The strictest government is taking place." Those who broke the rules were subjected to severe punishment or disgrace. They were flogged or made to ride the wooden horse or drummed out of camp. One man was whipped for making a disturbance in the time of public worship, another for desertion. Another received 20 stripes for striking an officer, another 30 for damning an officer. But change was maddeningly slow in coming. As scathing as any eyewitness description was that provided by a precocious young New Englander of loyalist inclinations named Benjamin Thompson, who, after being refused a commission by Washington, served in the British Army, later settled in Europe, renamed himself Count Rumford, and ultimately became one of the era's prominent men of science. Washington's army, wrote Thompson, was the most wretchedly clothed and as dirty a set of mortals as ever disgraced the name of a soldier. They would rather let their clothes rot upon their backs than be at the trouble of cleaning them themselves. To this nasty way of life, Thompson attributed all the putrid, malignant, and infectious disorders that took such a heavy toll. His loyalist bias notwithstanding, Thompson's portrayal was largely the truth. Such British commanders as Burgoyne and Percy were hardly to be blamed for dismissing Washington's army as peasantry, ragamuffins, or rabble in arms. Except for Greene's Rhode Islanders and a few Connecticut units, they looked more like farmers in from the fields than soldiers. That so many were filthy dirty was perfectly understandable, as so many, when not drilling, spent their days digging trenches, hauling rock, and throwing up great mounds of earth for defense. At one point, early in the siege, there were 4,000 men at work on Prospect Hill alone. It was dirty, hard labor, and there was little chance or the means ever to bathe or enjoy such luxury as a change of clothes. Few of the men had what would pass for a uniform. Field officers were all but indistinguishable from the troops they led. Not only were most men unwashed and often unshaven, they were clad in a bewildering variety of this and that, largely whatever they or others at home had been able to throw together before they trudged off to war. One Connecticut woman was reported to have fitted out 5 sons and 11 grandsons. They wore heavy homespun coats and shirts, these often in tatters from constant wear, breeches of every color and condition, cowhide shoes and moccasins, and on their heads old broad-brimmed felt hats, weathered and sweat-stained, beaver hats, farmers' straw hats, or striped bandanas tied sailor fashion. The tricorn, a dressier hat, was more likely to be worn by officers and others of higher status, such as chaplains and doctors. Only here and there might an old regimental coat be seen, something left over from the French and Indian War. The arms they bore were as various as their costumes, mainly muskets and fowling pieces, in effect shotguns, and the more ancient the gun, it seemed, the greater the owner's pride in it. The most common, and by far the most important, was the flintlock musket, a single-shot, smooth-bore, muzzle-loading weapon that threw a lead ball weighing about 1 ounce and which could inflict terrible damage. The average musket measured 5 feet and weighed about 10 pounds. Though not especially accurate, it could be primed, loaded, fired, and rapidly reloaded and fired again. A good musket man could get off 3 to 4 rounds per minute, or a shot every 15 seconds. The trouble now was that so many of the men, accustomed to firearms since childhood, used them any way they saw fit, almost any time they pleased, to start fires, for example, or blast away at wild geese. In order that officers could be distinguished from those in the ranks, Washington directed that major generals wear purple ribbons across their chests, brigadiers pink ribbons. Field officers were to be identified by different colored cockades in their hats. Sergeants were to tie a red cloth to their right shoulders. Washington himself chose to wear a light blue ribbon across his chest between coat and waistcoat. But then there was never any mistaking the impeccably uniformed, commanding figure of Washington, who looked always as if on parade. The day he officially took command at Cambridge, July 3rd, had been marked by appropriate martial fanfare, a great deal of grandeur, as Lieutenant Hodgkins, the Ipswich cobbler, recorded. 21 drummers and as many fifers, a beating and playing round the parade ground. A young newly arrived doctor from Barnstable, James Thatcher, assigned to the Army's hospital at Cambridge, described seeing the commander-in-chief for the first time. His Excellency was on horseback in company with several military gentlemen. It was not difficult to distinguish him from all others. His personal appearance is truly noble and majestic, being tall and well-proportioned. His dress is a blue coat with buff-colored facings, a rich epaulet on each shoulder, buff underdress, and an elegant small sword, a black cockade in his hat. The great majority of the army were farmers and skilled artisans, shoemakers, saddlers, carpenters, wheelwrights, blacksmiths, coopers, tailors, and ship chandlers. Colonel John Glover's regiment from Marblehead, who were destined to play as important a part as any, were nearly all sailors and fishermen. It was an army of men accustomed to hard work being the common lot. They were familiar with adversity and making do in a harsh climate. Resourceful, handy with tools, they could drive a yoke of oxen or hove up a stump or tie a proper knot as readily as butcher a hog or mend a pair of shoes. They knew from experience, most of them, the hardships and setbacks of life. Preparing for the worst was second nature. Rare was the man who had never seen someone die. To be sure, an appreciable number had no trade. They were drifters, tavern lowlife, some the dregs of society. But by and large, they were good, solid citizens, as worthy people as ever marched out of step, as would be said. Married men with families who depended on them, and with whom they tried to keep contact as best they could. It was the first American army, and an army of everyone. Men of every shape and size and makeup, different colors, different nationalities, different ways of talking, and all degrees of physical condition. Many were missing teeth or fingers, pitted by smallpox, or scarred by past wars, or the all-too-common hazards of life and toil in the 18th century. Some were not even men, but smooth-faced boys of 15 or less. One of the oldest and by far the most popular was General Israel Putnam, a hero of the Battle of Bunker Hill, who at 57 was known affectionately as Old Putt. Rough, thick-set, all bones and muscles and leathery, with flowing gray locks and a head like a cannonball, he was a Pomfret, Connecticut farmer who had survived hair-raising exploits fighting the French and Indians, shipwreck, even a face-to-face encounter with a she-wolf in her den, if the stories were to be believed. Old Putt also spoke with a slight lisp and could barely write his name, but as said, Old Putt feared nothing. At the other extreme was little Israel Trask, who was all of 10. Like the son of Lieutenant Jabez Fitch, Israel had volunteered with his father, Lieutenant Jonathan Trask of Marblehead, and served as messenger and cook's helper. John Greenwood, a fifer, one of the more than 500 fifers and drummers in the army, was 16, but small for his age and looked younger. Born and raised in Boston, he had grown up with the troubles always close to home. A young apprentice living in his house had been one of those killed in the Boston Massacre. Thrilled by the sound of the fifes and drums of the regulars occupying the city, John had somehow acquired an old split fife, upon which, after puttying up the crack, he learned to play several tunes before being sent to live with an uncle in Falmouth, Portland, Maine. In May 1775, hearing the news of Lexington and Concord, he had set off on foot with little more than the clothes on his back, his fife protruding from a front pocket. All alone, he walked to Boston, 150 miles, through what was still, much of the route, uninhabited wilderness. Stopping at wayside taverns where troops were gathered, he would bring out the fife and play a tune or two, as he would later recall. They used to ask me where I came from and where I was going to, and when I told them I was going to fight for my country, they were astonished such a little boy and alone should have such courage. Thus, by the help of my fife, I lived, as it were, on what is usually called free quarters, nearly upon the entire route. After reaching the army encampments, he was urged to enlist, with the promise of $8 a month. Later, passing through Cambridge, he learned of the battle raging at Bunker Hill. Wounded men were being laid out on the common. Everywhere the greatest terror and confusion seemed to prevail. The boy started running along the road that led to the battle, past wagons carrying more casualties and wounded men struggling back to Cambridge on foot. Terrified, he wished he had never enlisted. I could positively feel my hair stand on end. But then he saw a lone soldier coming down the road. A Negro man, wounded in the back of his neck, passed me, and his collar being open, and he not having anything on except his shirt and trousers, I saw the wound quite plainly and the blood running down his back. I asked him if it hurt much, as he did not seem to mind it. He said no, that he was only to get a plaster put on it and meant to return. You cannot conceive what encouragement this immediately gave me. I began to feel brave and like a soldier from that moment, and fear never troubled me afterward during the whole war. In response to concerns in Congress over how much of the Army was in fact made up of old men and boys, as well as Negroes and Indians, General William Heath reported, "There are in the Massachusetts regiments some few lads and old men, and in several regiments some Negroes. Such is also the case with the regiments from the other colonies. Rhode Island has a number of Negroes and Indians. The New Hampshire regiments have less of both." General John Thomas, who commanded the Massachusetts troops at Roxbury, also responded. "The regiments at Roxbury, the privates, are equal to any I served with in the last war. Very few old men, and in the ranks very few boys. Our fifers are many of them boys. We have some Negroes, but I look upon them in general equally serviceable with other men, for fatigue and inaction. Many of them have proved themselves brave." Like most Southerners, Washington did not want blacks in the Army and would soon issue orders saying that neither Negroes, boys unable to bear arms, nor old men were to be enlisted. By year's end, however, with new recruits urgently needed and numbers of free blacks wanting to serve, he would change his mind and in a landmark general order authorize their enlistment. While no contemporary drawings or paintings of individual soldiers have survived, a fair idea of how they looked emerges from the descriptions and notices posted of deserters. One George Reynolds of Rhode Island, as an example, was 5'9½" tall, age 17, and carried his head something on his right shoulder. Thomas Williams was an immigrant, an old countryman, who spoke good English and had a film in his left eye. David Relph, a saucy fellow, was wearing a white coat, jacket and breeches, and ruffled shirt when last seen. "Deserted from Colonel Brewer's regiment and Captain Harvey's company," said a notice in the Essex, Connecticut Gazette. "One Simeon Smith of Greenfield, a joiner by trade, a thin, spared fellow, about 5'4" high, had on a blue coat and black vest, a metal button on his hat, black long hair, black eyes, his voice in the hermaphrodite fashion, the masculine rather predominant. Likewise, Matthias Smith, a small, smart fellow, a saddler by trade, gray-headed, has a younger look in his face, is apt to say, 'I swear,' and between his words will spit smart. Had on a green coat and an old red greatcoat. He is a right gamester, although he wears something of a sober look. Likewise, John Davy, a long, hump-shouldered fellow, a shoemaker by trade, drawls his words, and for comfortable says comfable. He had a green coat, thick leather breeches, slim legs, lost some of his foreteeth." For every full-fledged deserter, there were half a dozen others inclined to stroll off on almost any pretext, to do a little clam-digging, perhaps, or who might vanish for several weeks to see wives and children, help with the harvest at home, or ply their trades for some much-needed hard money. Sometimes they requested a furlough. As often, they just up and left, only to come straggling back into camp when it suited. It was not that they had no heart for soldiering, or were wanting in spirit. They simply had had little experience with other people telling them what to do every hour of the day. Having volunteered to fight, they failed to see the sense in a lot of fuss over rules and regulations. It was midsummer by the time the first troops from outside New England began showing up, companies of riflemen from Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia. Hardy men, many of them exceeding 6 feet in height, noted Dr. James Thatcher, who was himself short and slight. One Virginia company, led by Captain Daniel Morgan, had marched on a beeline for Boston, covering 600 miles in 3 weeks, or an average of 30 miles a day in the heat of summer. Mostly backwoodsmen of Scotch-Irish descent, they wore long fringed hunting shirts, rifle shirts, of homespun linen, in colors ranging from undyed tan and gray to shades of brown and even black, these tied at the waist with belts carrying tomahawks. At a review, they demonstrated how, with their long-barreled rifles, a frontier weapon made in Pennsylvania and largely unknown in New England, they could hit a mark 7 inches in diameter at a distance of 250 yards, while the ordinary musket was accurate at only 100 yards or so. It was rifling spiraled grooves inside the long barrel that increased the accuracy, and the new men began firing at British sentries with deadly effect, until the British caught on and kept their heads down or stayed out of range. Welcome as they were at first, the riflemen soon proved even more indifferent to discipline than the New Englanders, and obstreperous to the point that Washington began to wish they had never come. Work on defenses went on steadily, the troops toiling with picks and shovels in all weather, sometimes working through the night when the heat of day was too severe. It was endless brute labor, but they were remarkably proficient at it, far more so than their British counterparts. As the size and reach of the defenses increased, visitors by the hundreds came to see for themselves. Roads were crowded with spectators to whom the giant ramparts were wondrous works. Nothing on such scale had ever been built by New Englanders before. Breastworks in many places 17 feet in thickness, trenches wide and deep. Verily, their fortifications appear to be the works of 7 years. The work parties were fired on from time to time. British and American sentries alike were fired on repeatedly. On August 2nd, as Lieutenant Samuel Bixby of Connecticut recorded in his diary, "One of General Washington's riflemen was killed by the regulars today, and then hung up by the neck." His comrades, seeing this, were much enraged and immediately asked leave of the general to go down and do as they pleased. The riflemen marched immediately and began operations. The regulars fired at them from all parts with cannon and swivels, but the riflemen skulked about and kept up their sharpshooting all day. Many of the regulars fell, but the riflemen lost only one man. Both sides staged sporadic night raids on the other's lines, or launched forays to capture hay and livestock from nearby harbor islands. The night of August 30th, the British made a surprise breakout at the neck, set fire to a tavern, and withdrew back to their defenses. The same night, 300 Americans attacked Lighthouse Island, killed several of the enemy, and took 23 prisoners with the loss of one American soldier. "Night was the time for frolicking," remembered John Greenwood, the fifer, "as the British were constantly sending bombs at us, and sometimes from 2 to 6 at a time could be seen in the air overhead, looking like moving stars in the heavens. Some early morning British bombardments lasted several hours, the British clearly having no shortage of powder. In one furious cannonade from the British works on Bunker Hill, a rifleman lost a leg, and a company clerk with Nathaniel Green's Kentish Guards, Augustus Mumford, had his head blown off." Mumford was the first Rhode Island casualty of the war, and the horror of his death moved Nathaniel Green as nothing had since the siege began. To his wife Katie, who was pregnant with their first child, Green wrote that he wished she could be spared such news, and any fears she had for his own safety. British deserters kept crossing the lines, usually at night and alone, but sometimes 3 or 4 together. Half-starved and disgruntled, they came from both Boston and from the British ships in the harbor, and nearly always with bits of news or descriptions of their travails, word of which would spread rapidly through the camps the next day. One night, a lone British light horseman swam his horse across. Another night, 15 men deserted the ships in the harbor. Then days would follow without incident, one day like another. An officer with a company of Pennsylvania riflemen wrote of nothing to do but pick blueberries and play cricket. "Nothing of note, nothing important, all quiet," Lieutenant Bixby of Connecticut recorded. On the other side, a British diarist drearily echoed the same refrain, writing, nothing extraordinary, day after day. Washington kept expecting the British to attack, and failed to understand why they would delay if an end to the rebellion was what they wanted. By the close of summer, with increasing losses from disease, desertions, and absences of one sort or other, his army was in serious decline. Spirits suffered. The patriotic fervor that had sent thousands rushing to the scene in late April and May was hardly evident any longer. It was not just that the army was shrinking, it was due to disappear entirely in a matter of months, the troops having signed on to serve only until the end of the year. The Connecticut enlistments would be up even sooner. It had been the common expectation that the rising of such an armed force as gathered outside Boston would cause the British to think again and reach an accommodation. A short campaign had been anticipated by nearly everyone, including Washington, who had told his wife he would be home by fall. There were still too few tents, still a shortage of blankets and clothing, and no one had forgotten that winter was on the way. Farmers and soldiers knew about weather. Weather could be the great determiner between failure and success, the great test of one's staying power. In truth, the situation was worse than they realized, and no one perceived this as clearly as Washington. Seeing things as they were, and not as he would wish them to be, was one of his salient strengths. He knew how little money was at hand, and he understood, as did no one else, the difficulties of dealing with Congress. He knew how essential it was to the future effectiveness of the army to break down regional differences and biases among the troops. But at the same time, he struggled with his own mounting contempt for New Englanders. Writing to Lund Washington, a cousin, and his business manager at home at Mount Vernon, he railed against the Yankees as exceeding dirty and nasty, nothing like what he had expected. He had only contempt for these people, he confided in a letter to Congressman Richard Henry Lee, another fellow Virginian. The heart of the problem was an unaccountable kind of stupidity in the lower class of these people, which, believe me, prevails but too generally among the officers, who are nearly of the same kidney with the privates. All such officers desired was to curry favor with the men and thereby get reelected. Still, he allowed, if properly led, the army would undoubtedly fight. And in a letter to General Philip Schuyler, who was in command at Albany, Washington insisted, possibly to rally his own resolve, that they must never lose sight of the goodness of our cause. Difficulties were not insurmountable. Perseverance and spirit have done wonders in all ages. On first arriving in Cambridge, Washington had been offered the home of the president of Harvard, Samuel Langdon, for his residence. But finding it too cramped for his needs and those of his staff, his military family, the general moved a few days later to one of the largest, most elegant houses in town, a gray, clapboard Georgian mansion half a mile from the college on the King's Highway. 3 stories tall with an unobstructed view of the Charles River, it belonged to a wealthy loyalist, John Vassal, who, fearing for his life and the lives of his family, had abandoned the place, fine furnishings and all, to take refuge in Boston. For Washington, who had a fondness for handsome architecture and river views, the house suited perfectly and would serve as his command headquarters through the siege, with his office established in a drawing room off the front hall. The house became a hive of activity, with people coming and going at all hours. It was there that Washington conferred with his highest-ranking officers, convened his councils of war, and with staff help coped with numberless problems of organization, issued orders, and labored over correspondence. Paperwork without end, letters to Congress, appeals to the governors of the New England states, and the legislature of Massachusetts. There, too, he received or entertained local dignitaries and politicians and their wives, always in elegant fashion, as was both his pleasure and part of the role he felt he must play. And as with everything connected with that role, his uniform, his house, his horses and equipage, the military dress and bearing of his staff, appearances were of great importance. A leader must look and act the part. To judge by surviving household accounts, Virginia hospitality more than lived up to its reputation at Cambridge. Purchases included quantities of beef, lamb, roasting pig, wild ducks, geese, turtle, and a variety of fresh fish, of which Washington was especially fond. Plums, peaches, barrels of cider, brandy and rum by the gallon, and limes by the hundreds, these to fend off scurvy. One entry accounts for payment to a man named Simon Lovett for carting a load of liquor from Beverly. The domestic staff included a steward, two cooks, one of whom was French, a kitchen maid, a washerwoman, eight others whose duties were not specified and included several slaves, plus a personal tailor for the commander, one Giles Alexander. Washington's body servant, a black slave named William Billy Lee, was his steady companion. Riding with Washington on his rounds of the defenses, Billy Lee became a familiar figure, a large spyglass in a leather case slung over one shoulder. As apparent to all, His Excellency was in the prime of life. A strapping man of commanding presence, he stood 6 feet 2 inches tall and weighed perhaps 190 pounds. His hair was reddish-brown, his eyes gray-blue, and the bridge of his prominent nose unusually wide. The face was largely unlined but freckled and sunbeaten and slightly scarred by smallpox. A few defective teeth were apparent when he smiled. He carried himself like a soldier and sat a horse like the perfect Virginia gentleman. It was the look and bearing of a man accustomed to respect and to being obeyed. He was not austere, there was no hint of arrogance. Amiable and modest were words frequently used to describe him, and there was a softness in his eyes that people remembered. Yet he had a certain distance in manner that set him off from or above others. "Be easy, but not too familiar," he advised his officers, "lest you subject yourself to a want of that respect which is necessary to support a proper command." It was a philosophy unfamiliar to most Yankees, who saw nothing inappropriate about a captain shaving one of his soldiers, or rough-hewn General Putnam standing in line for his rations along with everyone else. Nor was it easy for Putnam and others of the older officers to change their ways. On one occasion, surveying the work on defenses by horseback, Putnam paused to ask a soldier to throw a large rock in the path up onto the parapet. "Sir, I am a corporal," the soldier protested. "Oh, I ask your pardon, sir," said the general, who dismounted and threw the rock himself, to the delight of all present. The Philadelphia physician and patriot Benjamin Rush, a staunch admirer, observed that Washington has so much martial dignity in his deportment that you would distinguish him to be a general and a soldier from among 10,000 people. There is not a king in Europe that would not look like a valet de chambre by his side. A Connecticut delegate to the Continental Congress, Eliphalet Dyer, who had heartily joined in the unanimous decision to make Washington the commander-in-chief, judged him to be no harum-scarum fellow. John Adams, who had put Washington's name in nomination for the command, described him in a letter to his wife Abigail as amiable and brave. "This appointment," wrote Adams, "will have great effect in cementing and securing the union of these colonies," and he prophesied that Washington could become one of the most important characters in the world. After meeting the general herself for the first time, as a guest at one of his social occasions at Cambridge, Abigail wrote to tell her husband he had hardly said enough. Washington's effect on the troops and young officers was striking. Joy was visible on every countenance, according to Nathaniel Green, and it seemed as if the spirit of conquest breathed through the whole army. "I hope we shall be taught to copy his example, and to prefer the love of liberty in this time of public danger to all the soft pleasures of domestic life, and support ourselves with manly fortitude amidst all the dangers and hardships that attend a state of war." Joseph Reed, a young man with a long jaw and a somewhat quizzical look in his eyes, was a charming London-trained Philadelphia lawyer who had been chosen as part of an honorary escort when Washington departed Philadelphia for his new command. Reed had intended to ride only as far as New York, but found himself so in awe of the general that he continued on to Cambridge to become Washington's secretary, despite the fact that he had made no provisions for his wife and 3 young children or for his law practice. "As Reed explained, Washington had expressed himself to me in such terms that I thought myself bound by every tie of duty and honor to comply with his request to help him through the sea of difficulties." Few would ever provide a more succinct description of Washington's particular hold on men. Born in Tidewater, Virginia, on February 11, 1732, by the old-style calendar, George Washington was the great-grandson of John Washington, who had emigrated from Northampton, England, in 1657. His father, Augustine Washington, was a tobacco planter also known for his noble appearance and manly proportions. His mother, Mary Bell, was widowed when Washington was 11. Because of the family's reduced circumstances, he had had little education, only 7 or 8 years of schooling by private tutor, no training in Latin or Greek or law, as had so many prominent Virginia patriots, and as those close to him knew, he was self-conscious about this. By steady application, he had learned to write in a clear, strong hand and to express himself on paper with force and clarity. He learned to dance. Virginians loved to dance, and he was no exception. And he learned to comport himself in the elaborately polite society of the day with perfect manners and polish. In the 110 rules of civility and decent behavior in company and conversation that he had laboriously copied down as a boy, rule number 1 read, "Every action done in company ought to be with some sign of respect to those who are present." He enjoyed parties, and particularly the company of attractive women. As would be said of British officers, he liked his glass, his lass, his game of cards, though gambling never became the obsession it was for so many of his counterparts on the British side. The great teacher for Washington was experience. At age 16, he had set out to make his way in the world, as a surveyor's apprentice on an expedition into the wilderness of western Virginia, over the Blue Ridge Mountains, and as years passed, he spent more time in the back country beyond the Blue Ridge than all but a few from the Tidewater. In addition, surveying proved highly remunerative. In 1753, at 20, he had been sent by the governor of Virginia to the wilds of western Pennsylvania to challenge French claims to the Allegheny River Valley, and publication of his diary of the venture, the Journal of Major George Washington, made his daring and resourcefulness known throughout the colonies and in Europe. A year later, on his first command, inexperience and poor judgment led to his famous encounter with French troops and Indians at Great Meadows, in the same remote corner of western Pennsylvania. The small, bloody backwoods incident and first defeat for Washington that set in motion the conflict that ultimately involved much of the world. "I heard the bullets whistle, and believe me, there is something charming in the sound," he had written in a letter printed in the London Magazine, which could be taken as the bravado of a callow youth, but as he had found, he was one of those rare few who, under fire, were without fear. As a provincial officer fighting with the British Army during General Edward Braddock's defeat in western Pennsylvania, he had shown conspicuous courage under fire and marked ability for leadership. If, as a young officer, he seemed at times flagrantly, unattractively ambitious, he had long since overcome that. In 1759, spurned in his desire for a royal commission, he had retired at age 27 to the life of a Virginia planter, and that same year married Martha Dandridge Custis of Williamsburg, an attractive, extremely wealthy widow with 2 children, to whom he gave full devotion. The children, John Park Custis and Patsy, were treated quite as though they were his own. Indeed, one of the worst tragedies of Washington's life had been the death of 17-year-old Patsy of an epileptic fit in 1773. Like other planters of the Tidewater, Washington embraced a life very like that of the English gentry. English by ancestry, he was in dress, manner, and his favorite pastimes as close to being an English country gentleman as was possible for an American of the day, and intentionally. His handsome green coach with its brass fittings and leather lining had been custom-built in England to his specifications. He ordered his clothes from England, and only the finest English wools and linens and latest fashions would do. He wore English boots, English shoes, and Morocco leather slippers, all made to order for him in London. The books on his shelves, including the military treatises, were published in London. The very glass in the windows through which he viewed his domain was imported English glass. Only the year before taking command at Cambridge, Washington had commenced an ambitious expansion of his Virginia home, Mount Vernon. which, when completed, would double its size. He was adding a library and building a two-story dining room or banquet hall, suitable for entertaining on a grand scale. He was a builder by nature. He had a passion for architecture and landscape design, and Mount Vernon was his creation, everything done to his own ideas and plans. How extremely important all this was to him, and the pleasure he drew from it, few people ever understood. He had an abiding dislike of disorder and cared intensely about every detail, wallpaper, paint color, ceiling ornaments, and insisted on perfection. He hated to be away from the project, even at the distance of Cambridge, with all that weighed on his mind. He worried that things were not being handled as he wished at Mount Vernon and filled pages of instruction for his manager, Lund Washington. "I wish you would quicken Lanphier and Sears, the carpenters, about the dining room chimney piece, to be executed as mentioned in one of my last letters, as I could wish to have that end of the house completely finished before I return. I wish you had done the end of the new kitchen, next the garden, as also the old kitchen, with rusticated boards. However, as it is not, I would have the corners done so in the manner of our new church. What have you done with the well? Is that walled up? Have you any accounts of the painter?" Second only to his passion for architecture and landscape design was a love of the theater, which again was quite characteristic of Virginians. He had seen his first known theatrical production at age 19 on a trip with his older brother to Barbados. It was the first and only time Washington had ever been beyond American shores, and the place where he was strongly attacked by smallpox. Later, at Williamsburg, as a member of the Virginia legislature, he had attended the theater regularly. During a visit to Annapolis, he recorded going to the play 4 nights out of 5. In New York later, he attended the theater 7 times and saw his first production of Hamlet. But of all the theatrical productions he had seen, it was Cato, by the English author Joseph Addison, the most popular play of the time, that Washington loved best. One line in particular he was to think of or quote frequently in his role now as commander-in-chief. "'Tis not in mortals to command success. But we'll do more, Sempronius. We'll deserve it." Though Washington was often said to be the richest man in America, he probably did not rank among the 10 richest. He was very wealthy nonetheless, and in large part because of his marriage to Martha Custis. His wealth was in land, upwards of 54,000 acres, including some 8,000 acres at Mount Vernon, another 4,000 acres in Virginia's dismal swamp, nearly all of which he had acquired for speculation. In addition, he owned more than 100 slaves, another measure of great wealth, whose labors made possible his whole way of life. In a popular English novel of the day, The Expedition of Humphrey Clinker, Tobias Smollett wrote that to be a country gentleman, one was obliged to keep horses, hounds, carriages, with suitable numbers of servants, and maintain an elegant table for the entertainment of his neighbors. It could have been a description of life at Mount Vernon, with the difference that the servants were black slaves. Among the Virginia gentry who had taken up fox hunting, with an exuberance no less than to be found on the country estates of England, Washington stood out. Thomas Jefferson considered him the best horseman of his age. That Washington was known to hunt up to 7 hours straight, riding as close to the hounds as possible, leaping fences and going extremely quick, and always to the end, to be in on the kill, was considered not only a measure of his love of the chase and his exceptional physical stamina, but also of his uncommon, unrelenting determination. Billy Lee, the body servant, rode with him, rode like the wind by all accounts, and no less fearlessly than his master. Found a fox in Mr. Phil Alexander's island, which was lost after a chase of 7 hours, Washington recorded in his diary at the end of one winter day in 1772, but he did not give up, as shown in his entry for the day following. Found a fox in the same place again, which was killed at the end of 6 hours. An English sporting writer of a later era would describe fox hunting as the image of war without its guilt and only half its danger. In some years, according to Washington's own records, the days he devoted to fox hunting added up to a month. He kept precise account of exactly how long each chase lasted, to the minute. Again, he was a man who loved precision in everything. Stories were told of extraordinary feats of strength, how, for example, Washington had thrown a stone from the bed of a stream to the top of Virginia's famous Natural Bridge, a height of 215 feet. The Philadelphia artist Charles Wilson Peale, who had been a guest at Mount Vernon in 1772 while painting Washington's portrait, described how he and several other young men were on the lawn throwing an iron bar for sport, when Washington appeared and, without bothering to remove his coat, took a turn, throwing it far, very far, beyond our utmost limit. Washington's wealth and way of life, like his physique and horsemanship, were of great importance to large numbers of the men he led and among many in Congress. The feeling was that if he, George Washington, who had so much, was willing to risk his all, however daunting the odds, then who were they to equivocate? That he was also serving without pay was widely taken as further evidence of the genuineness of his commitment. There were, to be sure, those in the ranks and among the local populace who had little fondness for Virginia planters and their high and mighty heirs, or who saw stunning incongruity in the cause of liberty being led by a slave master. It was also a matter of record that Washington had been retired from military life for 15 years, during which he had not even drilled a militia company. His only prior experience had been in backwoods warfare, a very different kind of warfare, and most notably in the Braddock Campaign of 1755, which had been a disaster. He was by no means an experienced commander. He had never led an army in battle, never before commanded anything larger than a regiment, and never had he directed a siege. Washington was quite aware of his limitations. In formal acceptance of the new command on June 16, 1775, standing at his place in Congress, he had addressed John Hancock. "I am truly sensible of the high honor done me in this appointment. Yet I feel great distress from a consciousness that my abilities and military experience may not be equal to the extensive and important trust. However, as the Congress desire it, I will enter upon the momentous duty, and exert every power I possess in their service and for the support of the glorious cause." He knew he might not succeed, and he gave Congress fair warning. "But lest some unlucky event should happen unfavorable to my reputation, I beg it may be remembered by every gentleman in the room that I this day declare with the utmost sincerity I do not think myself equal to the command I am honored with." To his wife Martha he wrote that, "far from seeking this appointment, I have used every endeavor in my power to avoid it, not only from my unwillingness to part with you and the family, but from a consciousness of its being a trust too great for my capacity. It has been a kind of destiny that has thrown me upon this service." Yet he had attended Congress in his splendid blue and buff uniform, conspicuously signaling a readiness to take command. If he saw the responsibility as too great for his ability, it was because he had a realistic idea of how immense that responsibility would be. For such a trust, to lead an undisciplined, poorly armed volunteer force of farmers and tradesmen against the best trained, best equipped, most formidable military force on earth, and with so much riding on the outcome, was in reality more than any man was qualified for. But he knew also that someone had to take command, and however impossible the task and the odds, he knew he was better suited than any of the others Congress might have in mind. Without question, Congress had made the right choice, and not the least of reasons was political. As a Virginian, Washington represented the richest, most populous of the 13 colonies. He himself had had years of political experience in the Virginia legislature and as a member of the Continental Congress. It was as one of them that the members of Congress knew him best and respected him, not as a general. He knew the ways of politics and factious politicians. He understood how the system worked. For all the delays and frustrations, however severe the tests of patience he was to suffer in his dealings with them and the system, he never forgot that Congress held the ultimate power, that he, the commander-in-chief, was the servant of some 56 delegates who, in far-off Philadelphia, unlike Parliament, met in secrecy. In the first days of September, Washington began drawing up plans for two bold moves. He had decided to carry the war into Canada with a surprise attack on the British at Quebec. 1,000 men from the ranks, longing for action, volunteered at once. Led by an aggressive Connecticut colonel named Benedict Arnold, they were to advance on Quebec across the Maine wilderness, taking a northeastern route up the Kennebec River. Hastily conceived, this secret expedition was based on too little knowledge of the terrain. But in small units, the men began marching off for Newburyport, north of Boston, from where they would sail by sloop and schooner to the mouth of the Kennebec. He felt he could detach 1,000 troops this way, Washington informed Congress, because he had concluded from intelligence gathered from spies and British deserters that the enemy in Boston had no intention of launching an attack until they were reinforced. His second plan was to end the waiting and strike at Boston, which it was understood could mean destruction of the town. British defenses were formidable. In fact, defenses on both sides had been strengthened to the point where many believed neither army would dare attack the other. Also, a siege by definition required a great deal of prolonged standing still and waiting. But standing still and waiting were not the way to win a war, and not in Washington's nature. "The inactive state we lie in is exceedingly disagreeable," he had confided to his brother John. He wanted a speedy finish, to fight and be done with it. "No danger is to be considered when put in competition with the magnitude of the cause," he had asserted earlier in a letter to the governor of Rhode Island. According to his instructions from Congress, he was to take no action of consequence until advising with his council of war, and thus a meeting was scheduled for the morning of September 11th. "To know," he informed his generals, "whether, in your judgment, we cannot make a successful attack upon the troops in Boston by means of boats." On September 10th, mutiny broke out among the Pennsylvania riflemen, after several of the worst troublemakers had been confined to the guardhouse. Though the mutiny was put down at once by General Greene and a large detachment of Rhode Island troops, it only added to the sense of an army coming apart, and Washington was visibly shaken. The Council of War convened in his office as scheduled the next morning, three major generals, including the venerable Israel Putnam, and four brigadiers. All were New Englanders but one, Major General Charles Lee, who was Washington's second in command and the only professional soldier present. A former British officer and veteran of the French and Indian War, Lee, like Washington, had fought in the ill-fated Braddock campaign and later settled in Virginia. He was a spare, odd-looking man with a long, hooked nose and dark, bony face. Rough in manner, rough of speech, he had nothing of Washington's dignity. Even in uniform, he looked perpetually unkempt. Lee might have been a character out of an English novel, such were his eccentricities and colorful past. He had once been married to an Indian woman, the daughter of a Seneca chief. He had served gallantly with the British army in Spain and as aide-de-camp to the King of Poland. Like Frederick the Great, he made a flamboyant show of his love for dogs, keeping two or three with him most of the time. A New Hampshire clergyman, Jeremy Belknap, after dining with the general in Cambridge, thought him an odd genius, a great sloven, wretchedly profane, and a great admirer of dogs, one of them a native Pomeranian which I would have taken for a bear had I seen him in the woods. Lee was also self-assured, highly opinionated, moody, and ill-tempered. His Indian name was Boiling Water, and he was thought by many to have the best military mind of any of the generals, a view he openly shared. Washington considered him the first officer in military knowledge and experience we have in the whole army, and it was at Washington's specific request that Congress had made Lee second in command. Whatever opinions Lee had of Washington, he kept to himself, except to remark that he thought the appellation Excellency perfectly absurd. In striking contrast to Lee was Major General Artemus Ward, a heavy-set, pious-looking Massachusetts farmer, storekeeper, justice of the peace, and veteran of the French and Indian War, who had had overall command of the siege of Boston prior to Washington's arrival. Ward was considered a good man, a thorough New England man, though uninspiring. General Lee privately called him a fat old church.